Change doesn't wait. Sometimes it storms in, sometimes it creeps quietly, unfolding in ways we notice later. It stirs in boardrooms, classrooms, streets, and communities, wherever people act with purpose. What moves you? A vision? A challenge? A belief in business as a force for good? And what holds you back? External factors or limiting beliefs? I'm Gary Watts, and this is Moved, the podcast of 289 people inspiring change. I'll be speaking with people exploring what first moved them, what they've achieved, and the challenges they've had to overcome, both outside and within. Each episode is about human performance, leadership, sustainability, doing the work that matters, and the moments that change everything. This is Moved. Today, I'm joined by John Pearce. John has been CEO of Made in Britain since 2015, overseeing its growth into a major trade body with over 2,100 member companies. Under his leadership, the Made in Britain trademark has become a symbol of quality, provenance, and high standards in British manufacturing. Before this role, he played a key part in the UK government's Great Britain campaign, promoting trade, tourism, and education overseas. John is a strong advocate for provenance marketing, which emphasises the importance of where something is made. Alongside this, he has championed responsible business and sustainability, where he's encouraging members to innovate, and he also serves on the advisory panel for the UN Global Compact UK Network. John is a well-known voice for British manufacturing in policy, media, and international conversations. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, really good to see you again. So it was on the it was a UN Global Compact UK breakfast event that we met for the first time, wasn't it?
I think so, yeah. I can't remember exactly when it was, but the UN Global Compact, the UK network is very strong, and it seems to get stronger and stronger every year, and more necessary, of course.
Yeah, we'll definitely get into that a little bit more. But when we met on that, I remember it standing out to me in terms of your role with Made in Britain and manufacturing. Obviously, there's a few questions I've been wanting to ask you since we met briefly on that. And I guess the first one would be, actually, what first drew you into the world of manufacturing in general?
Well, I was invited to start an organisation that was really grassroots in origin. So a group of manufacturers got together. They wanted a trademark that would serve all of British manufacturing, mainly in the SME category. There were about 350 companies that said they wanted to boost manufacturing, really, and to promote it in a way that would be universal across all the different manufacturing sectors of the, let's call it, the productive economy, so making things. They registered a trademark like that. And the registered trademark was really a galvanizing point. Mm. So everyone that's got involved in it, in Made in Britain as an organization, has agreed that the trademark is the main point of entry to understand what products are made where, which companies are making them, and who's responsible for the quality and the distribution of those products.
Mm. Yeah, that'd be really interesting to get into more. And you'd not really had an involvement in manufacturing before you joined that organization?
Prior to Made in Britain, I was working for the Great Campaign for the government. And of course, companies like JCB and Triumph and some of the great famous British manufacturers were involved in the Great Campaign. Mm. But what I didn't have any idea of was how hard it is to make a profit in manufacturing. So I knew there was a business case for making things locally, certainly an environmental case for making things locally. Mm. But the challenges of manufacturing and how we can more effectively promote the sector with one trademark and promote it in the whole so they're all feeling better about themselves as we promote them. Mm. It's a sort of virtuous circle, if you like, of promotion, but also identification for the general public. So they know what's made in this country and what isn't.
Yeah. And you mentioned it being difficult to make a profit in manufacturing. So it's a kind of an area where there's a lot of pressure then.
I think so, yeah. I mean, I've always, the more and more I understand about British manufacturing, the more I've got to grips with the challenges, the real challenges of, the price of energy, the accessibility of materials, the labour force that is really more expensive. You know, it's more expensive to employ people here than it is elsewhere. And I think that that sort of suite of challenges economically, if you like, to making a profit, that's where the real beauty of the manufacturing sector is, in that, that you know, they're a group that know what they're doing, they're passionate about it, they carry on doing it. And of course, a lot of them are making products absolutely essential to the British society and the economy, infrastructure, defence, construction, you name it. We've got manufacturers that are really key to the way the country operates successfully.
Mm. And where did the inspiration for Made in Britain originally come from? And actually, I'm interested in the logo, the trademark you just shared with me as well. Can you tell me about the provenance of that in itself?
One of the things about the trademark that people often overlook is that it was actually designed to be fit for purpose. So somebody sat down, well, I know the people that sat down, it was a design team, sat down and actually drew up something that was fit for purpose and fit for the future. So the idea was that you're identifying with a pointing arrow, and the pointing arrow points to the business. It's what's called a collective trademark. So we register it in every product class. And then the applicants that want to join in with Made in Britain, they have to prove that they're manufacturing, and they have to stick to the rules of the mark, which mean that you're only putting it on things that you make in this country.
Mm-hmm.
Some of our members do import some things. They import, you know, things in a range, items in a certain range that they can't make and sell effectively or profitably in this country. But all the things that they make in this country, they're qualified to put Made in Britain on them. And they have to show us how they're using the mark as well. And we make a record of that so that we've got an idea of every manufacturer being honest about identifying their products that are made in this country with the trademark. And I think that identity and the affection that people have for the mark, it's affection for the trademark itself as a design, but it's also an affection for the idea of a group of companies getting together and promoting themselves. We do have competing companies in the same membership using the same trademark, but they've agreed that this is a good way to promote the whole sector and raise awareness of how important it is to have British-made goods that are made closer to home.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see that effect, the affection that you mentioned. I can see that. I mean, I have that affection when I see that. It's something you just feel like an affinity for. Do you notice anything into any observations in terms of what that affection is like overseas or in any particular countries versus how we might feel about seeing it in this country?
Well, we haven't done any sort of official measures of that. We do a lot of surveying of the British public and of our members to see how they're using the mark and how the public recognise the mark. And in business sectors, up to 80% of the business people that we've asked in surveys do recognise the mark in some way. And in the public, that's 50%, which is lower. But obviously, a lot of the times the trademark is appearing on things that the public wouldn't necessarily see. You know, hidden infrastructure, cables, fittings, building blocks, etc. of the industry, and you wouldn't necessarily see the mark on those things. So our recognition in this country is very high. But we've never done any measures of you know, how British things are perceived overseas. But we do have an awful lot of anecdotal evidence. And we know that our members are, in the main, our members are all exporters. 70% of our members have told us they are exporting their products to at least one, if not hundreds, in some cases, of countries. So we know the mark is being used as an identity for products and almost as a sort of brand ambassador for British made. And that's a really important part of what the group can do to grow the British economy from an export point of view. You know, these are all companies that are trying to increase their exports. They're trying to do the best they can under very difficult circumstances. But again, the Made in Britain mark sort of gives them a bit of self-confidence about how their goods will be received, you know, not just in current markets, but in new markets as well. You're sending a new product to a new market with Made in Britain on it, it gives it an extra bit of oomph when it gets there.
Have you seen any examples of other countries doing something similar? So you have obviously Made in Britain for here, but are there other countries that you'd say are also leaders in this that are doing this really well?
Well, of course, I would say that we're the world leader.
Of course.
I mean, everyone is doing it. You know, everyone is doing it. You know, everyone is sort of thinking about locally made. It's really, really important. I mean, but of course you can't make everything, not all countries can make everything in their own country. Mm. There are lots of other campaigns around the world, and we do keep quite a close eye on them. There is Made in France, Made in Germany, Made in Italy, etc., etc. I think the difference really with Made in Britain is that we are entirely independent. So our organization is literally owned and run by the members. So I'm responsible for running it as a group of 2,212 members, I think we are this morning. So we tick up, you know, there's a growth in membership every day almost. But no, I think being independent and being the Made in Britain permanent campaign to promote British manufacturing with an independence that it means we're controlled effectively by the members that are using this mark, I think does give us an edge over those campaigns that might be necessarily controlled almost completely by another party or controlled by one or two big companies. We're not like that. You know, we are universal across the piece. We're affordable for all the manufacturers. Nobody is really paying an enormous amount of money to be in this. What they're doing is paying a license fee. And that does set us apart. But we do try and interact with other places that are trying to promote local manufacturing. It's important that everyone realizes that, yeah, if we haven't got it here, then we've got to make it in France or Germany or somewhere as close as possible, you know, and bring it in. And that works reciprocally as well, of course.
Mm. Yeah, really interesting. Can you tell me anything about the actual community, like the, I know it's quite large, but the range of manufacturers that you have in there and a little bit about the community itself?
Yeah, the diversity is really the extraordinary thing. It's one of the most stimulating things about running the organization, to be honest. I mean, we have literally companies making candles, defense equipment, building blocks of industry, bricks, mortar. We've got absolutely everything. The strongest sectors by employment are probably defense, because some of our big defense companies employ literally thousands of people. Then perhaps the most important sector is the construction sector. You know, we have 450 something businesses that are involved in some way in the construction sector. And if we're going to sort of build our way out of the current crisis and build more homes, affordable homes, etc., you know, those companies become really important. But they're not just building homes, of course, they're making products for the infrastructure that we need to renew as well. The other important sector for now, if you like, is the renewable energy and supportive industries sector. So, you know, any industry that is trying to be part of the green transition of energy is really important to bring down the price of energy, because that's very important to British manufacturing profitability. Mm-hmm. But all the sectors, I think what surprised me the most about across that diversity of 40 different product sectors, you know, it's when we do webinars for procurement or exports, or we run webinars for our members to help them to sell more of what they make. But when we bring the members together, I'm always surprised at how the commonality of being a manufacturer works, whether you're making candles, shoes, vans, or armored vehicles, frankly. Mm. You know, this is a vital thing to do. You know, we humanity and society can't get by without things. We need tables and chairs and homes to live in and cars to drive, etc. But the people that are making things do have a shared sense of purpose about their contribution to the what I call the productive economy.
Yeah, it's a like creative act, isn't it?
It's an act of creation. It's also an act of service, you know, because you're serving society with something that will hopefully last a long time. Of course, lots of products don't last a long time, but lots of them do. And lots of our members have been around serving their local community, their regional community, the whole country and the export community. You know, we've got companies that have been on record for 100 years or more.
Wow.
One of them 175 years, actually.
Goodness. Yeah. Fascinating. That's really interesting. What's a typical week like for you in Made in Britain?
Well, in the early stages, the typical week was spent a lot of time in front of a computer trying to work out how the organisation would be run. But these days, I tend to spend my week, I obviously have admin days because being chief exec, I have to administer and run and manage and plan for the organization's success. But I do spend a lot of time in London with our partners, which we have partners in the Department of Business and Trade, because that's really important that we're in a constant positive dialogue with them about what manufacturers are doing, you know, where they're succeeding, what government could do to help them succeed more. We're not a lobby group as such, but we are in an open, constructive dialogue with government, and I do spend time in London. And then the rest of my time is trying to get to as many factories as possible. Mm. You know, I've always been a bit of a factory visit junkie in a way. You know, it's a beautiful thing to be able to see how people are working together on their premises to make something, often something that I wouldn't even be able to identify. You know, some of these internal bits of machinery and gadgets and widgets of industry are sometimes just fascinating by their sheer complexity or simplicity. So I like to spend as much of my time with the members as I can. And we exhibit, of course. We exhibit at all the political conferences. We exhibit there to raise awareness of manufacturing with all 650 MPs. We exhibit with the UNGC in mind on the circular economy, which is very important to our members that are trying to reduce the amount of material footprint that they have and to try and reduce their waste footprint. And we are constantly, you know, promoting our members' stories to that world. So our members tell us the stories of success, and we promote those on social media and in conventional media. So it's a busy week, but it's always interesting. And we do have 20, sometimes 30 new members every month. So part of my work is to establish what we do when suddenly a new company joins and they're making something that we don't know about. We need to sort of onboard them into the organization and make sure their voice is heard.
Yeah, that sounds really nice. It sounds like there's a personal touch going on. Even though the community is maybe getting quite large, you're getting a lot of new members each week. And the way that you want to actually visit those places of manufacture, visit those factories and actually see it, I know that'll only be a portion of the time, but it sounds like a really important portion of the time.
Yeah, and we do have a team. Obviously, there's a team of people that will be out there visiting. And part of our members' commitment to joining is that they tell us contractually that they're happy for us to go and visit their premises to see what they're up to. How are they using the trademark? What are they making? Where are they sending it? And where are they selling it? You know, they are the kind of companies that are really keen to receive people. And one of our functions nowadays is actually to find dignitaries and policymakers and actually take them to factories and say, look, this is what's going on in your constituency, in your neighborhood even. We even have actually, we've created a search code like that. And if you zap the search code QR, you'll go straight into a postcode search and you can find out all the manufacturers within walking distance of your home. So we're trying to make the whole story as accessible as possible, whilst providing an evidence base as to why you should buy something British.
Yeah, really interesting. You mentioned a few things related to sustainability, and I think that's where I'd like to come on to next, because obviously that's where we first met at the UN Global Compact UK event. And yeah, you've touched on some things there, but just to get into it a little bit more, can you tell me a little bit about the shifts that you're seeing or that you think we need to see in terms of sustainability in manufacturing?
Goodness, perhaps we should do another podcast for this one.
And obviously, hopefully it's mainly about opportunity, but I can imagine also it's difficult.
Yeah, it is. It's extremely difficult. I mean, manufacturers, as I've already alluded to, you know, I think they've got the most challenging profit environment ever. I mean, you know, to make something, regardless of what it is, you need people, you need a premises, you need materials, you need loads of water, loads of energy, loads of human energy. You need designers, lawyers, you need absolutely everything. So to run a manufacturing business successfully is already an enormous challenge. When you put on top of that environmental regulations and then add on, you know, ethical regulations, i.e., you know, how you feel personally about resource scarcity, you've got a paradigm there of to make a business green that, you know, I often say this, you know, making an insurance company greener is relatively straightforward. But if you're a company that uses thousands of liters of water every day, and that water has to be circulated in a system to cool down a machine that you need for, you know, I could go on and on and on, but manufacturers, it's much, much harder for them to go green. And so what we do is, instead of sort of bombarding them with consultants, etc., what we do is we draw out what they're already doing. by asking them to tell us within a framework that we call ESV, so environmental and social value. Mm-hmm. And what that does is sort of give a framework for the members to, we give them a simple framework where they can describe everything they're doing for the environment. How are they reducing waste? How are they using recycled materials? Lots of our members are making their thing out of 100% recycled materials. You know, what are they doing to support their workers and to grow their working economy? So improve the lives of the people that work for them and stimulate them with interesting and meaningful work across the whole business. How does their product affect society once it's in society? You know, how long does it last? Mm. You know, how, if you're making street furniture, how long will it be out there serving the public as street furniture, etc.? And this sort of framework of what we call ESV is really about encouraging the members to be prouder of the fact that they're trying to become more green, but also giving them a little sort of idea of the gaps that might be in place. For example, if you tell an SME business that, look, if you circulate a green policy across all of your employees, you've already ticked perhaps the most important box, which is socializing the idea that we're trying to be less impactful or less negatively impactful on the environment and on the economy and society. This is adding a tremendous amount of value into the British economy. And of course, people don't perhaps look to manufacturers for the green messaging. You know, they tend to think, oh, oil and gas or, you know, mining. But these are companies that are making tables and chairs and trying to do it as green as possible. And we're very proud with the fact that, you know, our members are shining a light on how fast businesses are trying to go circular. Some of them are definitely going circular on raw materials. They're trying to use greener energy. They're trying to be less impactful on the environment and more, tread more gently in a world where, you know, we know that time is running out for us to do the cleanup and to be, you know, to have less negative effects on the environment that we live in. So I think manufacturers are they know what they've got to do. We actually help them and encourage them to be a bit more proud and a bit more assertive and to articulate their story a little bit clearer so that the public know when you're buying British, you're actually buying something that has environmental, social, economic value all at the same time.
Mm, really interesting. I'm fascinated by a lot of that, but in particular by the circularity part. And I think we had a conversation about this last time, because the circularity would almost be seen by probably most people as being a really good thing, you know, produce less, you know, consume less, but actually for a manufacturer, that's not necessarily going to be, you know, retail and so on. Actually, if you're making less things, selling less things, it's not easy to run a business that's already under pressure. But you mentioned that you'd been seeing some examples of circularity in manufacturing. I'm almost intrigued to hear about some of the successes that you've seen there where it's working.
I think circularity for manufacturers is perhaps the only topic. I mean, you know, the thing about circular economy is that for manufacturers, for most of them, probably all of them really, you know, the idea of a non-circular economy is long-term existential threat.
Yeah.
You know, you're taking materials and turning them into something to run a business that sells them, you know, and the materials are getting more and more scarce. The environmental consequences of moving the materials from one place to another, those are we're seeing what the negative consequences of that are. Mm. The companies that I know about that are pioneering, if you like, on the circular economy are starting with materials. So we have companies that make all of their outdoor furniture from old plastic. So almost a case of sort of turning litter into park benches that last a long time. You know, these are highly durable items that you'll see out there in the streets. If you have a look, you'll find outdoor furniture that is made in Britain and it's made from old plastic. On metals, we have a company in the Midlands that is making copper tube out of scrap copper. You know, they've invested many millions in a new plant where you can effectively pour in scrap copper one end and they produce 100% beautiful copper pipes that are needed right across the economy. Mm-hmm. And they're doing that at scale. You know, this is a big dark, scary factory that is doing, you know, that is trying to reduce the copper mountain, some of which the scrap copper is actually shipped off these islands, you know, to somewhere else. I have heard anecdotally that in materials like glass, that the UK is already quite circular, you know, that we have lots of glass in circulation and that glass is well recycled and that, you know, we have enough glass, if you like. But some of the materials, and I think I have to include water in the circular economy discussion because all my members need water. And some of them need water in order to make their thing. So, you know, if we're putting constraints on the water economy in order to make things, you know, those companies have to be super aware. And I have heard very recently that that there are processes now of water use within a manufacturing business where the water is in a continuous loop. So it's cleaning itself and sending itself through. And I have heard from our members as well that are making liquid products. So you've got paint, obviously, which has a high water usage in a paint system. There are detergents. There are lots of things that are effectively liquid products. And those companies are really, really conscientious about their water use and their water distribution and not putting even more strain on the water system that we all rely on for drinking and household use. So I think the signs are really, really strong. But of course, you know, these are companies that are acting, not talking. They're talking a little bit, but they're acting a lot to try to make the British economy more circular. And what we do is to try and, you know, demonstrate to the public and to politicians and academics and say, look, this isn't a theoretical discussion. These are companies that are already going circular and they're trying to do it as fast as possible. So the more we emphasize that, the quicker we'll go circular. And most of us who are thinking and dreaming about a fully circular economy believe the sooner that happens, the better.
Wow. John, this is so powerful. So you're seeing shifts, you're seeing progress, you're seeing really interesting developments. And I love the things that it heartens me. You know, the CEO of Made in Britain is talking so passionately about these things. And you touched on something really profound in terms of the community of manufacturers that you're interacting with. They're like doing, not talking. Obviously they're talking sometimes, but these are actual actions. And we sometimes hear of, you know, greenwashing and, you know, if you've got a brand, maybe you can, but actually with manufacturing, you're really seeing these significant breakthroughs in that the effort that's been put on it. And that clearly for you, it's so important too. So it's really heartening to hear about it.
Well, you know, we've all got relatives. We've all got children. Well, not all of us have got children, but you know, we've all got people in our the circular economy of society, if you like. You know, everyone knows this is happening. We know we have to pick up all the litter, we know we have to clean the air, clean the water, etc. Yeah. etc. But I think there is a difference between those that are talking and acting, and British manufacturers, I know we've got strong evidence that British manufacturers are acting to become more circular. And yes, that's complicated. You have to collaborate. Sometimes you have to collaborate with competitors, you know, but they do that. And manufacturers know how to do that. They know how to collaborate with all sorts of people because you cannot not be a collaborator and be a successful manufacturer. That's what manufacturers do. You know, they are an extreme collaboration exercise and trying to produce a profit at the end of that exercise. And I do have, as you probably detect, I've got a lot of admiration for them as businesses because dare I say it, anyone can create a new search engine because you just sit there at the laptop and do it. But, you know, not anyone can craft a new saddle for the royal family. We've got businesses that will do that, you know, craft a saddle for the royal family from scratch, you know. That's not everyone can do that.
But, no, it's quite artisan.
Yeah, it's quite artisan, And we've got those businesses. In fact, we have a whole selection of companies that do make saddles and all sorts of goods out of leather and plastics and glass. And, you know, they're a really interesting group. They are growing and they are definitely trying to make the world a better place faster than it's becoming worse, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. Do you think we tell that story enough? Because obviously the Made in Britain story is really powerful. The logo mark is really strong. I think people instantly recognize it. You mentioned the affection for it.
This one.
And I know you're right. It's around actions more than the stories. But the stories that you're telling them I've not heard them before. I would recognize Made in Britain, but I wouldn't necessarily associate it with some of those stories that you're telling. And do you think we should do more to tell the stories too?
Yeah, I do. And I think Made in Britain are playing a part. There are lots of other trade bodies that focus on manufacturing. There's Make UK, there is SMMT, that are manufacturing of vehicles. There are all sorts of bodies, specialized bodies sometimes, that only focus on one area of manufacturing. We are all doing our best to tell the story of how important manufacturing is. And, you know, Made in Britain is part of a community of manufacturing enthusiasts, really, both amateur and professional enthusiasts, etc. What we've done to try to sort of emphasize them, our members' actions, is we have a news platform for our members that's really, really active. We will get anything up to 30 news stories a day from our members, and they publish them on our website. Now, if you go over and look at a news website, certainly a business news website, and see how many stories there are about British manufacturers, you won't find 30 a day. We are, in certain sectors of the economy, we are very definitely a niche. You know, people don't know that there's only one maker of scissors and tennis balls and certain other things. You know, there are literally only one remaining manufacturer of those things in the country. And that's perhaps an uncomfortable truth for some people. But it doesn't mean to say that we stop pushing the button and raising awareness of that one remaining scissor maker, and where are they and who are they employing? How are they trying to survive for the next 100 years? Those stories are really important. And I think the other point of this is that our news from manufacturing is the manufacturers talking about themselves. So we're not sort of saying this, you know, let's bring back the Industrial Revolution. You know, this is manufacturers that are existing or trying to carry on and trying to plan for the future right now, here in 2025. You know, things aren't the same as they were in the Industrial Revolution. And the ones that are surviving, as I say, we have hundreds that have been around for 50 years or more, literally hundreds of businesses. So they know what longevity is, but their story now is part of communicating with the general public and with society and trying to let everyone know that we all need things, and we always will need things. You know, you can't sit on AI. You need to sit on a chair.
Yeah, that's a good slogan right there, isn't it? You can't sit on AI. Yeah, I've not heard that one before. But makes a lot of sense now that you say.
I don't know where it came from, but yeah, I mean, it's true, isn't it? You know, for all of the importance of AI and obviously, you know, well, you can't make AI without servers, and servers have got to be made, and they've got to be cooled, and they need copper wiring, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, we will always need things. Yeah. And we will always need equipment to process food, and we'll always need equipment to cleanse water. You know, we will always need these things. And the sooner, or at least the nearer to home they're made, the better.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's a powerful intersection between provenance and sustainability then.
I think so, yeah. I think the two dovetail really well. They're not always, they don't always meet in the middle, because some people, when you discuss provenance of something, they tend to move towards patriotism.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But where we've bridged that gap is with evidence. Mm-hmm. So we've never said to people, when you see that mark, spend your money because it's Britain.
Yeah.
Some people might think like that. But what we want to do is say, look, spend your money on something that's identified like that because it represents environmental, social, and economic value to the UK. You know, and how else could you make a decision about what to buy, or where else could you make, where you're bringing together all of those factors in one place? And I think the gap does have to be bridged. There is a chasm between, you know, somebody that wants to buy something just because it's got a British flag on it. Somebody wants to buy something because it represents environmental and social and economic value for the UK. And, you know, it does, uncomfortable for some, but it does come down to taxpaying businesses, taxpaying people contributing to the British economy, so that we have the goods and services that we all need from, you know, to keep us all glued together.
Yeah, powerful stuff. Can you tell me, touch on the role that you have with the UN Global Compact then? Because I think you're on the advisory panel, you have an advisory panel role with them. When did that role begin?
Oh, crumbs. Quite a few years ago. I think I've been on the advisory panel. We've been members. Made in Britain has been members of the UNGC for, I think, 6 years. I can't remember. It's 5 or 6 years. But I was invited onto the advisory panel because they needed an industrial voice.
Yeah.
One of the beauties of Made in Britain is that I've got an industrial voice across the productive economy from the point of view of companies turning over 1 million versus, in many cases, a billion. You know, so we've got that enormous scope of business size, but we've also got all of them sort of able to declare an industrial story. And all too often in environmental groups, as I alluded to earlier, you know, you find plenty of people who are prepared to talk the talk of environmentalism, but understanding the statistics and the data and the actions of a company that is consuming thousands of liters of water and metals and trying to get rid of waste, and you've got all these very real practical challenges of environmental awareness and responsibility, that's a voice that in often in environmental and sustainability rooms, it's a voice that's completely missing. Now, what are industry doing not to be compliant? Because compliance, as in some sectors, compliance is a piece of cake. You just tick the boxes. But compliance in water cleansing for a company that's using thousands of liters every day, that's not just a tick box exercise. That means water. You know, it means clean water in, clean water out. So, you know, I think the beauty of that group is incredibly diverse. Both the UNGC is diverse, all sorts of sectors. And obviously the economy isn't just about manufacturing. It's about all sorts of other supporting roles as well to make the economy work. But in my view, you know, the material economy and the productive economy that are making the things has a much more, a much broader responsibility to the environment. And I think that's why we were invited in to contribute with the environmentalism from an industrial point of view, from companies that are already acting. So we're not just complying for compliance, we're acting to try and make things better faster than they are becoming worse.
Yeah, so you're bringing that perspective in. Yeah, that's really good. You've really brought it alive for me, because, you know, I could easily think in terms of, you know, say my line of work, like doing a podcast, coaching, consulting, that in terms of sustainability for me, or, like, you know, being greener in terms of my business is relatively straightforward. It's, you know, probably largely to do with my commute or, you know, how I'm commuting. But actually, when I really think about it, the things you've said, I'm just looking around now and everything I'm surrounded by has been manufactured. I'm looking at a camera, a laptop, a screen, a mic, a desk, carpet, curtains, the whole room is things that have been made, and actually made. The provenance of it, and actually the extent to which circularity might have featured and so on. You really, yeah, visually brought it alive for me as I'm sitting in this room.
Well, it's that difference between a linear economy, of course, and a circular one. And circular enthusiasts, and I consider myself one, you know, kind of obsessed with, you know, how we work out how best to do this and how we get a move on, because it is urgent. You know, the material economy is not going to be there forever if we keep on digging stuff out of the ground. And yes, we can grow certain materials. Wood is a good example. You know, we have really good responsibility levels in material management of certain materials, but there, you know, there isn't a ministry for materials to make sure Britain's got all the materials it needs. And what are we running out of? What do we need to make all these things that we definitely will need in the future? You know, everything depends on materials and some kind of material strategy. And I think that's one area, if I did ever have the opportunity to insist upon that in a policy environment, I think we do need a better sight of what materials we've got and what we don't have, you know, and where are we going to get the things that we don't have?
Yeah, it's almost a podcast topic in itself, isn't it? Like materials are off the earth and they go back into the earth. And like you say, it's kind of an urgent thing.
Yeah, it is.
Profound. Very good. I have some quick fire questions, only a few just brief ones, but what is one British made product you love or admire?
Oh, you can't have favourite members when you're in my line of work. But I'm going to go back to copper, because the copper story, the copper tube is something, it was one of the first factories I visited. And to see that they produce copper tube and now they're producing copper tube from 100% scrap, I would say that's one of my favourites. But a product, I've thought of another one actually. There's another product that is a favourite, is that half of Britain's wheelie bins are made in Britain by one of our members.
Okay.
So I've got three wheelie bins in our neighbourhood where I live, and lots of people have more than one wheelie bin. But almost half of Britain's wheelie bins are identified as made in Britain. They're made in Shropshire by a company called Kramer. So
yeah.
I'll go wheelie bins.
Yeah, excellent. I never noticed that. And I'm
from Shropshire as well, so it's a bit of favouritism.
Oh, very good. If you could change one thing about how Britain tells its manufacturing story, what would it be?
Oh, crumbs, one story. I think I would... I would magic a way for everyone to be able to look at something and know how many materials are being used in it, you know, whenever you're going to buy something. You know, you come up with a magic QR code that you could zap and it would tell you how close to where you are the product you're buying was made. That's what I think. Let's call it a proximity button.
Yeah.
You know, where you zap it on an app. I mean, it's probably technical possible. Maybe AI could do it, but mm-hmm. I think it would be really helpful for people to understand how far away from where they are the product that they're buying was made, you know, because we have some, of course, we've got members that are, this is meant to be quick fire, wasn't it? But we've got members making things and serving their local hospital, for example. So they might be providing a product that's made literally within miles of a local hospital. And that kind of proximity story is a really strong one at Made in Britain. So a proximity buy button, let's call it that.
I love it. And in fairness, it was a very open question for me. So you're absolutely right to answer it in the way that you did. Final couple of, this one's a bit of an open question, but it's a world that's fast moving. And actually on this front, many people can feel a little bit of despair. Like it's quite hard. And like, are we, you know, what would be some advice that you'd want, or a message that you want to leave with listeners in terms of positive things that they can do?
I think beyond sort of buying something made in Britain, because they know where it's been made, I think the thing about, the economy now, especially for young people, you know, to perhaps sort of counter a bit of the despair that some of them might be feeling about work, is to think about joining a manufacturing business, you know, first. Because one of the beauties of manufacturing is that you'll be working with other people. And you'll be working with other people, like, really, not virtually. So you will be in the same place, socially interacting with people at work to decide how to make something better or faster or cheaper or more expensive, but you'll be working with people in a physical space at a work of premises. And there is so much evidence, because I've read it, on how that is good for us. Is it good for the human spirit to be interacting with other people? Like, this is fine, but in person is even better for us. So I would say to perhaps a glimmer of hope is that, you know, one of the things Made in Britain does is identify successful businesses that are doing interesting things, and they will be offering what I call meaningful work. You'll never walk around a manufacturing premises and point at somebody and say, oh, what are you doing? They won't know what they're doing. Everyone at manufacturing knows what they're doing. They're not gazing at the sky and wondering what is the meaning of life. They know what they're doing because more than likely the thing that they're doing will have a direct impact on the product that the company makes. So join manufacturing, or think about joining manufacturing, to find meaningful work, but also to connect with other human beings, because we know that's going to be really good for your mental and physical health.
Yeah. I know it's really powerful when you're working with people together, and actually when you're on the ground, either making something or providing something. Yeah, really good. Actually, so wherever...
Nothing worse than isolation, really. You know, isolation at work is really, really... it's a real problem for so many people that are forced to work in isolation. But manufacturers, generally speaking, don't. You know, they're generally working with colleagues. So.
So wherever the listeners are right now, there might be a factory or manufacturer near where you are that might also be using the Made in Britain logo mark on some of their things. So, yeah, go and visit.
Scan that barcode.
Yeah.
Scan that code. I'll hold it for a second. Scan that code or go to our website. Search for their local postcode and they'll find somebody making something close to them. And I know from all the manufacturers I spoke to, you knock on the door and say, oh, can I have a look at what you're up to? Obviously, if they're in the defense sector, they might not let you in. Yes. But, you know, if they're making tables and chairs for obvious reasons. But, you know, if they're making tables and chairs, yeah, or candles or lava lamps or wheelie bins, you know, they will probably, with a bit of time and effort, you could arrange a visit. And if it's schools, lots of schools go into manufacturing premises to see what people are doing and see what it's like to actually make stuff.
Hmm. So consider it as a career choice, definitely.
Absolutely.
Very good. So if people want to find out more, you mentioned the website, I'll put it in the show notes, but where would people go to find out more?
I think the website is the place to go to find out, you know, what we're up to. There is a product directory, there's a membership directory, there's a news directory. Those three things sit together, and they're all part of the same database. It's a giant database of evidence that the British manufacturing is doing well, is thriving under very difficult conditions. But that evidence is saying, you know, we should be buying things made closer to home. You know, if you can, buy something made in Britain, buy something British made, because it represents an enormous amount of environmental, social and economic value to the UK.
Yeah, fabulous. John, I knew when we met, even though it was very brief at the breakfast event, that I would love you as a guest on the podcast. And it's been a fascinating conversation. I've really enjoyed it. I feel like I've learned some things. So thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for joining me on this episode of Moved. If it sparks something for you, subscribe and share it with someone who's looking to make a difference. I'm Gary Watts, and I'll see you next time as we explore what moves people and ideas forward.